Disc 3.
How did Sean Dunn pull off sending you letters inside an envelope like this? Benton shakes the photocopy at Marino. And don't you find it just a little odd that first-class mail is X'd out? Why might that be? I guess we'll just have to get Wolfman to explain, Marino rudely replies. I got no fucking idea. Yet you seem to know for a fact that the letters are from Jean-Baptiste. Benton measures each word. Pete, you're better than this. Marino wipes his forehead on his sleeve. Look, so the fact is we don't got scientific evidence to prove nothing, but it's not because we didn't take a shot at it. We did use the Lumalite, and we did try for DNA, and everything's whistle clean as of this moment. Mitochondrial DNA, you trying for that? Why bother? It would take months, and by then he'll be dead. And there's no way in hell we're going to get a goddamn thing anyway. For crying out loud, don't you think the asshole gets off on somehow using a National Academy of Justice envelope? How's that for a fuck you? Don't you think he gets off on making us do all these tests when he knows we'll come up with zip? All he had to do was cover his hands with toilet paper or whatever when he touched anything. Maybe, Benton says. Marino is about to erupt. He is exasperated beyond his limit. Easy, Pete, Benton says. You would think less of me if I didn't ask. Marino stares off without blinking. My opinion, Benton goes on. He wrote the letters and was deliberate about not leaving evidence. I don't know how he managed to use a National Academy of Justice envelope, and yes, that is a huge fuck you. Frankly, I'm surprised you haven't heard from him before now. The letters sound authentic. They do not have the off-key ring of a crank. We know Jean-Baptiste has a breast fetish. He says this clinically. We know it is very likely he has information that could destroy his criminal family and the cartel. It fits with his insatiable need to dominate and control that he presents the conditions he has. And what about him saying the doc wants to see him? You tell me. She never wrote him. I asked her point blank. Why the hell would she write that piece of shit? I told her about the National Academy of Justice envelopes that the letter to her and me came in one. I showed her a photocopy. Of what? Benton interrupts. A photocopy of the National Academy of Justice envelope. Marino is getting exasperated. The one her and my letters from Wolfman came in. I told her if she gets one of these goddamn National Academy of Justice envelopes herself, not to open it, not to even touch it. Do you really believe he wants her to be his executioner? If he intends to die. Intends? Marino interrupts him. I don't believe old Wolfie boy's got much to say about that. A lot can happen between now and then, Pete. Remember who his connections are. I wouldn't be too sure of anything. And by the way, when Lucy got her letter, was it also sent in a postage-paid National Academy of Justice envelope? Yup. The fantasy of a woman doctor administering the lethal injection and watching him die would be erotic to him, Benton muses. Not just any doctor. We're talking about Scarpetta. He victimizes to the end, dominates and controls another human being to the end, forces a person to commit an act that will scar forever. Benton pauses before he adds, You kill someone, you never forget him, now do you? We have to take the letters seriously. I do believe they are from him, fingerprints, DNA or not. Yeah, well, I believe they're from him, too, and that he means what he says, and that's why I'm here if you ain't figured it out yet. If we can get Wolfman to sing, we move in on all his daddy's lieutenants and put the Sean Dunn cartel out of business, and you got nothing to worry about anymore. Who is we? I wish you'd quit saying that. Marino gets up to help himself to another beer. Anger and frustration flare again. Don't you get it? He calls out, rummaging inside the refrigerator. After May 7th, after we got the goods and Wolfman's dead, there ain't no reason for you to be Tom What's-His-Name anymore. Who is we? Marino snorts like a bull as he pops open a bottle of Dos Equis this time. We is me. We is Lucy. Does Lucy know you came to see me today? No, I didn't tell anyone and won't. Good. Benton doesn't move in his chair. Wolfman gives us pawns to knock off the board. Marino plans on without him. Maybe he's already given us our first pawn by ratting out Rocco. I can only figure that somebody must have ratted him out if he's suddenly a fugitive.
I see.
How honorable of Sean Dunn, if your son is his first pawn. Will you visit Rocco in prison, Pete? Marino suddenly smashes the beer bottle in the sink. Glass shatters. He strides over to Benton and gets in his face.
Shut up about him, you hear me? I hope he gets fucking AIDS in prison and dies. All the suffering he's caused. Now it should be his goddamn turn.
Who's suffering? Benton doesn't flinch at Marino's hot, beery breath.
Your suffering? Start with his mother's suffering, and keep on going.
Marino still has a hard time thinking about Doris, his ex-wife and Rocco's mother. She was Marino's sweetheart when he was in his prime. He still thinks of her as his sweetheart, long after he stopped paying attention to her. He was stunned when she left him for another man. While this is crossing Marino's mind, he is yelling at Benton.
You can come home, you fucking idiot! You can live your life again!
Marino sits down on the couch, breathing hard, his face a deep red that reminds Benton of the 575M Maranello Ferrari he has seen around Cambridge. Its color is a deep burgundy called Barchetta, and thinking of that car reminds him of Lucy, who has always been in love with fast, powerful machines.
You can see the dock and Lucy and...
Untrue, Benton whispers.
Jean-Baptiste Chandon has manipulated himself into this position. He is exactly where he wants to be. Connect the dots, Pete. Go back to how it started after he was arrested. He shocked everyone by offering an unsolicited confession to yet another murder, this one in Texas, and then, of all things, pled guilty. Why? Because he wanted to be extradited to Texas. It was his choice, not the governor of Virginia's.
No way, Marino challenges.
Our ambitious Virginia governor didn't want to piss off Washington by pissing off France, the anti-death penalty capital of the world, so we gave Sean Dunn to Texas.
Benton shakes his head. Not so. Jean-Baptiste gave Jean-Baptiste to Texas.
And how the hell would you know, anyway? You talking to people? I thought you didn't talk to no one.
Benton doesn't reply.
I don't get it, Marino goes on. Why would Wolfman give a shit about Texas?
He knew he would die quickly there, and he wanted to die quickly. It was part of his master plan. He had no intention of rotting on death row for 10 or 15 years, and his chances of gamesmanship are much greater in Texas. Virginia might very well fold to political pressure and stay his execution. Virginia is also claustrophobic. His every move would be watched. He would get away with much less because law enforcement and corrections officers would make it their mission to ensure his safety and good behavior. He would be monitored to the extreme. Don't tell me that if he were in Virginia his mail wouldn't be secretly checked. The hell with his legal rights.
Virginia would want to fry his ass, Marino argued, after what he'd done.
He killed a store clerk. He killed a cop. He almost killed the chief medical examiner. The governor at that time is now a senator and chairman of the Democratic National Committee. He didn't piss off Washington because he wasn't about to piss off the French. The governor of Texas, now in his second term and a trigger-happy Republican, by the way, doesn't give a damn who he pisses off.
The chief medical examiner? You just can't bring yourself to say her name, can you?
Marino exclaims, incredulous. 19. A few years back, Lucy Farinelli's Aunt Kay recalled an anecdote about the decapitated head of a German soldier who died in World War II. His body was discovered buried in sand somewhere in Poland, she recounted to Lucy, and arid conditions remarkably preserved his Aryan short blonde hair, attractive features, and even the stubble on his chin. When Scarpetta saw the head in a Polish forensic medical institute showcase while visiting as a forensic lecturer, she thought of Madame Tussaud's, she said. His front teeth are broken, Scarpetta went on with the story, explaining that she didn't think the damaged teeth were a post-mortem artifact or due to an antemortem injury that had occurred at or around the boyish Nazi's death.
He simply had poor dental care. Loose contact gunshot wound to the right temple, she cited the Nazi's cause of death. The angle of the wound points the way the gun was directed, in this case downward. Often in a suicide, the muzzle will be straight on or directed upward. There's no soot in this case because the wound was cleaned, the hair around it shaved at the morgue, where the mummified remains were sent to make certain the death wasn't recent, or so I was told when I was lecturing at the Pomorska Akademia Medicina. The only reason Lucy is reminded of the decapitated Nazi as her car is being searched at Germany's northeast border is that the German guard is a handsome, blue-eyed blonde and seems much too young to be infected with ennui as he leans inside her black rental Mercedes and sweeps the leather seats with a flashlight. Next, he sweeps the black carpeted floor, the strong beam illuminating Lucy's scuffed leather briefcase and red Nike duffel bags in back. He makes several bright stabs at the front passenger seat, then moves around to the trunk, popping it open. He shuts it with scarcely a glance. Had he bothered to unzip those two duffel bags and dig through clothing, he would have discovered a tactical baton. It looks rather much like a black rubber fishing pole handle, but with a quick flip of the wrist extends into a 2-foot-long thin rod of carbonized steel, capable of shattering bone and shearing soft tissue, including the internal organs of the belly. Lucy is prepared to explain the weapon, which is relatively unknown and unused except by law enforcement. She would claim that her overly protective boyfriend gave her the baton for self-defense because she is a businesswoman and often travels alone. She really isn't quite sure how to use the thing, she would sheepishly explain, but he insisted and promised it was perfectly all right to pack it. If police confiscated the baton, so what? But Lucy is relieved that it is not discovered, and that the officer in his pale green uniform checking her passport from inside his booth does not seem curious about this young American woman driving alone late at night in a Mercedes. "What is the purpose of your visit?" he asks in awkward English. "Geschäft." She doesn't tell him what kind of business, but has an answer prepared, if necessary. He picks up the phone and says something Lucy is unable to decipher, but she senses he isn't talking about her, or if he is, it is nothing. She expected her belongings to be riffled through and was ready for it. She expected to be quizzed. But the guard who reminds her of the decapitated head returns her passport. "Danke," she politely says, as she silently labels him a traquenard. The world is full of lazy fools like him. He waves her on. She creeps forward, crossing the border into Poland, and now another guard, this one Polish, puts her through the same routine. There is no ordeal, no thorough search, not a hint of anything but sleepiness and boredom. This is too easy. Paranoia sets in. She remembers she should never trust anything that is too easy, and she imagines the Gestapo and SS soldiers, cruel specters from the past. Fear rises like body odor, a fear that is baseless and irrational. Sweat rolls down her sides beneath her windbreaker as she thinks of Poles overpowered and disenfranchised from their own names and lives during a war she knows about only from history books. It is not so different from the way Benton Wesley exists, and Lucy wonders what he would think and feel if he knew she was in Poland and why. Not a day goes by when he doesn't shadow her life. 20. Her career experience does not show, unless she intentionally displays it like a weapon. She was still in high school when she began interning for the FBI and designed their criminal artificial intelligence network known as Kane. When she graduated from the University of Virginia, she became an FBI special agent and was given free rein as a computer and technical expert. She learned to fly helicopters and became the first female member of the FBI Special Forces hostage rescue team. Hostility, harassment, and crude innuendos followed her on every deployment, raid, and punishing training session. Rarely was she invited to join the men for a beer in the academy bar called the Boardroom. They did not confide in her about raids gone wrong, or their wives and children or girlfriends. But they watched her. There was talk about her in the showers. Her career with the FBI was aborted on a dewy October morning when she and her HRT partner, Rudy Musil, were shooting live 9mm rounds inside the FBI Academy's tire house. As its name implies, the highly dangerous indoor range was filled with old tires that tactical agents could dive over, duck under, dart around, and hide behind as they practiced maniacal maneuvers. Rudy was breathing hard and sweating as he crouched behind a mound of tires and smacked another magazine into his Glock, peering around a threadbare Michelin as he looked for Lucy, his partner.
"All right! Come clean!" he yelled at her through gun smoke. "What's your sexual preference?"
"To have it as often as possible!" She reloaded and snapped back the slide while rolling between stacks of tires before firing 5 rounds at a pop-up target 30 feet away. The cluster of headshots was so tight it looked like a small flower.
"Oh, yeah?"
2 bullets loudly clinked a pop-up thug holding a machine gun.
"Me and the guys got bets on it."
Rudy's voice came closer as he crawled on his belly across the filthy concrete floor. He pounced through towers of sooty tires and grabbed an unsuspecting Lucy by her steel-reinforced Red Wing boots.
"Gotcha!"
he laughed, setting his pistol on top of a tire.
"Are you fucking crazy?"
Lucy cleared around from the chamber of her pistol, the ejected cartridge bouncing off the floor.
"We're using live ammo, you fucking idiot!" "Let me see that thing."
Rudy got serious.
"It doesn't sound right."
He took the pistol from her, dropped out the magazine.
"Loose spring."
He shook the pistol before setting it next to his gun on the tire.
"Aha! Rule number 1. Never lose your weapon."
He got on top of her, laughing as he wrestled with her, somehow believing this was what she had been waiting for, and that she was excited and didn't mean it when she continued screaming,
"Get off of me, asshole!"
Finally, he restrained both her wrists in one of his powerful hands. He plunged the other inside her shirt and shoved his tongue inside her mouth as he pushed up her bra.
"The guys only say," he panted, "you're a dyke, 'cause,"
he fumbled with her belt buckle,
"they can't have you."
Lucy bit through Rudy's bottom lip and knocked her forehead hard against the bridge of his nose. He spent the rest of the day in the emergency room. FBI attorneys reminded her that litigation benefited no one, especially since Rudy believed that she wanted it and had probable cause to believe it. Lucy told Rudy she wanted it as often as possible, he reluctantly stated in the forms he was forced to complete for internal affairs. It's true, Lucy calmly agreed, during a sworn statement before a panel of 5 lawyers, not one of whom represented her. I said that, but I didn't say I wanted it with him or with anyone right then in the middle of live fire, in the middle of the tire house, in the middle of a maneuver, in the middle of my period.
But you'd led him on in the past. You'd given Agent Moozel reason to think you were attracted to him.
What reason? Lucy was baffled under oath. Offering him a stick of gum now and then? Helping him clean his guns? Hanging with him to run the yellow brick road and other obstacle courses, the worst one at the Marine Corps base, joking around, that sort of thing?
Quite a bit of togetherness, the lawyers agreed with one another.
He's my partner. Partners have quite a bit of togetherness.
Nonetheless, you seem to devote quite a lot of your time and attention to Agent Moozel, including personal attention, such as asking him about his weekends and holidays and calling him at home when he was out sick. Perhaps joking around, as you put it, might have been interpreted as flirting. Some people joke around when they flirt.
The lawyers agreed once again, and what was worse, 2 of them were women. Women in masculine skirt suits and high-heel shoes. Women whose eyes reflected an identification with the aggressor, as if their irises were glued onto their eyeballs backward and were dull instead of bright and blind to what was in front of them. The women lawyers had the dead eyes of people who kill themselves off to get what they want, or to become what they fear.
"I'm sorry," Lucy said as her attention sharpened and she avoided the dead eyes. "You stepped on me. Please repeat," she muttered aviation jargon.
"I'm sorry. Who stepped on you?"
Frowns. "You interfered with my transmission to the tower. Oops, there is no tower. This is uncontrolled airspace, and you get to do whatever you want, right?"
More frowns.
The lawyers glanced at one another as if Lucy was very weird.
Never mind, she added.
You're an attractive single woman. Can you see how Agent Muzil must have misinterpreted joking around, phone calls at home, etc., as your being sexually interested in him, Agent Farinelli?
It has also been stated that you often refer to Agent Muzil and yourself as Yin and Ilang.
I've told Rudy 100 times that Ilang is a Malayan tree. Ilang Ilang, to be more precise, a tree with yellow flowers that perfume is distilled from. But he doesn't always tune his ears to the right frequency. Lucy fought a smile. The lawyers were taking notes.
I never called Rudy Ilang. Now and then I did call him Yang, and he called me Ying, no matter how many times I told him the word was Yin, Lucy explained further.
Silence. Pen poised.
It has to do with Chinese philosophy?
Lucy might as well have been talking to a chalkboard. Balance, counterparts?
Why did you call each other whatever?
Because we're two peas in a pod. Do you know that expression?
I think we're familiar with the term two peas in a pod. Again, such nicknames suggest a relationship.
Not the kind you're talking about, Lucy replied without rancor, because she did not hate Rudy in the least.
He and I are two peas in a pod because neither of us fit in. He's Austrian, and the other guys call him Muesli because he's, quote, full of shit, which he doesn't think is the least bit funny. And I'm a lesbian, a man-hater, because no normal woman who likes men would want to be HRT and make the cut, according to the laws of machismo.
Lucy scanned the women's dead eyes and decided the male attorney's eyes were dead, too. The only sign of life in them was the glint of small, miserable creatures who hated someone like Lucy because she dared to resist being overpowered and frightened by them.
"This interview, deposition, inquisition, whatever the hell it is bullshit," Lucy told them. "I have no interest in suing the fucking Bureau of Investigation. I took care of myself in the tire house. I didn't report the incident. Rudy did. He had to explain his injuries. He claimed responsibility. He could have lied, but he didn't, and the two of us are eye to eye."
She used the word eye to remind the lawyers of their dead eyes, as if somehow the lawyers knew their eyes were dead and incapable of seeing a reality that flexed with truth and possibilities and begged humans to partake of it and war against the dead-eyed people who were ruining the world.
"Rudy and I have acted as our own mediator," Lucy went on calmly. "We have re-established that we are partners, and one partner doesn't do what the other doesn't want or commit any act that might betray the other partner or place him or her in harm's way. And he told me he was sorry, and he meant it. He was crying."
"Spies say they are sorry. They also cry."
A flush was climbing up the throat of a hostile woman attorney in pinstripes and skinny high heels that reminded Lucy of bound feet.
"And your accepting his apology isn't an option, Agent Farinelli. He attempted to rape you."
She emphasized the point, assuming it would humiliate and victimize Lucy again by inviting the male attorneys to envision her naked and sexually assaulted on the sooty concrete floor of the tire house.
"I didn't know Rudy was accused of being a spy," Lucy replied.
She resigned from the FBI and was hired by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which the FBI unfairly considers a collection of backwoods boys who bust up moonshine stills and wear tool belts and guns. She became an expert fire investigator in Philadelphia, where she helped stage Benton Wesley's murder, which included procuring the body of an anatomical donation bound for dissection at a medical school. The dead man was elderly, with thick silver hair, and after he was incinerated inside a torched building, a visual identification was unreliable, if not impossible. All a shocked Scarpetta saw at the filthy, water-soaked, smoking scene was a charred body and a faceless skull with silver hair and a titanium wristwatch that had belonged to Benton Wesley. Under secret orders from Washington, the chief medical examiner in Philadelphia was ordered to falsify all reports. On paper, Benton was dead. Just one more homicide added to the FBI's crime statistics for 1997. After he vanished into the black hole of the Witness Protection Program, ATF immediately transferred Lucy to the Miami field office, where she volunteered for dangerous undercover work, and talked her way into it, despite reservations on the part of the special agent in charge. Lucy had an attitude. She was volatile. No one close to her except Pete Marino understood why. Scarpetta didn't know or remotely suspect the truth. She assumed Lucy was going through a terrible phase because she couldn't cope with Benton being dead, when the truth was that Lucy couldn't cope with Benton's being alive. Within a year of her new post in Miami, she shot and killed two drug dealers in a takedown that went bad. Despite video surveillance tapes that clearly showed she had saved herself and the life of her undercover partner, there was talk. There was ugly gossip and disinformation, and one administrative investigation after another. Lucy quit ATF. She quit the feds. She cashed in her dot-com stocks before the economy destabilized and crashed after 9/11. She invested a portion of her wealth, along with her law enforcement experience and talent, into creating a private investigative agency she calls The Last Precinct. It's where you go when there's no place left. It isn't advertised or listed in any directory. 21. Benton gets up from the chair and slips his hands into his pockets. "People from the past," he says. "We live many lives, Pete, and the past is a death. Something over, something that can't come back. We move on and reinvent ourselves." "What a load of crap. You've been spending too much time alone," Marino says in disgust, as fear chills his heart. "You're making me sick. I'm glad as hell Scarpetta ain't here to see this. Or maybe she ought to, so she'd finally get over you, like you've obviously gotten over her. God damn it, can't you turn up the air conditioner in this joint?" Marino strides over to the window unit and turns it on high. "You know what she's doing these days, or don't you give a flying fuck? Nothing. She's a goddamn consultant. Got fired as the chief. Can you believe it? The fucking governor of Virginia got rid of her because of political shit. And getting fired in the middle of a scandal don't help you get much business," he rants on. "When it comes to her, no one's hiring, unless it's some pissant case in some place that can't afford anyone, so she does it for nothing. Like some stupid drug overdose in Baton Rouge. A stupid-ass drug OD." "Louisiana?" Benton wanders toward a window and looks out. "Yeah, the coroner from there called me this morning before I left Richmond. Some guy named Lanier. An old drug OD. I knew nothing about it, so then he wanted to know if the doc's doing private work and basically wanted me to vouch for her character. I was pretty fucking pissed. But that's what it's come down to. She needs fucking references." "Louisiana?" Benton says again, as if there must be some mistake. "You know any other state with a city named Baton Rouge?" Marino snidely asks above the noise of the air conditioner. "Not a good place for her," Benton says oddly. "Yeah, well, New York, D.C., L.A. ain't calling. It's just a damn good thing the doc's got her own money, otherwise she'd be..." "There are serial murders going on down there," Benton starts to say. "Well, the task force working them ain't the one calling her. This hasn't got nothing to do with those ladies disappearing. This is chicken shit, a cold case. And I'm just guessing the coroner will call her, and knowing her, she'll help him out." "An area where 10 women have vanished, and the coroner calls about a cold case? Why now?" "I don't know. A tip." "What tip?" "I don't know." "I want to know why that drug OD's so important all of a sudden," Benton persists. "Are your antennas in a knot?" Marino exclaims. "You're missing the fucking point. The doc's life has turned to shit. She's gone from being Babe Ruth to playing Little League." "Louisiana's not a good place for her," Benton says it again. "Why did the coroner call you? Just for a reference?" Marino shakes his head as if trying to wake up. He rubs his face. Benton's losing his grip. "The coroner called wanting my help with the case," he says. "Your help? Now what the hell is that supposed to mean? You don't think I could help somebody with a case? I could help any goddamn..." "Of course you could. So why aren't you helping the Baton Rouge coroner?" "Because I don't know anything about that case. Jesus, you're making me crazy." "The Last Precinct could help down there." "Would you fucking give it a rest? The coroner didn't seem all that hot and bothered by it.
just indicated he might want the doc's medical opinion. Their legal system is based on the Napoleonic Code. Marino has no idea what he's talking about.
What's Napoleon got to do with anything?
The French legal system, Benton says. The only state in America that has a legal system based on the French legal system instead of the English. Baton Rouge has more unsolved homicides of women per capita than any other city in America.
All right, already. So it ain't a nice place.
She should not go down there. Especially alone. Not under any circumstances. Make sure of it, Pete. Benton is still looking out the window. Trust me on this one.
Trust you? What a joke.
The least you can do is take care of her. Marino is incensed, staring at Benton's back. She can't go anywhere near him.
Who the hell are you talking about?
Marino asks, his frustration intensifying. Benton is a stranger. Marino doesn't know this man.
Wolfie boy? Jesus! I thought we were talking about a drug overdose case in Cajun country,
Marino complains. Keep her out of there.
You've got no right asking me anything, especially about her.
He's fixated on her.
What the hell does he have to do with Louisiana?
Marino steps closer to him and scrutinizes his face, as if straining to read something he can't quite see. This is a continuation of a power struggle he lost with her in the past, and he intends to win it now if it's the last thing he does.
Don't sound to me like he's gonna win a goddamn thing when he gets pumped full of enough juice to kill a herd of horses.
I'm not talking about Jean-Baptiste. Have you forgotten the other Sean Dunn, his brother? The last precinct should help the coroner. She shouldn't. Marino doesn't listen. He feels as if he's sitting in the back seat of a moving car that has no one at the wheel.
The doc knows what Wolfman wants of her.
Marino sticks with one subject, the one that interests him and makes sense.
She won't mind giving him the needle, and I'll be right there behind the smoky glass, smiling.
Have you asked her if she minds? Benton looks out at another spring day dying gently. Tender, vivid greens are dipped in golden sunlight, and shadows deepen closer to the ground.
I don't need to ask.
I see. So you haven't discussed it with her.
I'm not surprised. It wouldn't be like her to discuss it with you.
The insult is subtle, but stings Marino like a sea nettle. He has never been intimate with Kay Scarpetta. No one has ever been as intimate with her, not the way Benton was. She hasn't told Marino how she feels about being an executioner. She doesn't discuss her feelings with him.
I've depended on you to take care of her, Benton says.
The air seems to heat up, both of them sweating and silent.
I know how you feel, Pete,
Benton softly says.
I've always known. You don't know nothing.
Take care of her.
I came here so you could start doing that,
Marino says. 22. Carthage Bluff Landing is a good popular stop for groceries and gas, but Bev Kiffin never docks there. She doesn't slow down as she motors past and approaches Tin Lizzie's Landing, a restaurant that cost $1 million to build from torn-down shacks and what Bev calls salvage shit. Rich people from the mainland can access Lizzie's from the Springfield Bridge and eat all the Cajun steaks and seafood and drink all they want without having to go home after dark in a boat. 6 months ago, Bev asked Jay to take her there for her birthday, and he just laughed, and then his face twisted in a snarl as he called her stupid and ugly and out of her mind to think he'd take her to a restaurant at all, much less an upper-class one accessible by a highway. Jealousy smolders as Bev picks up speed, heading due west to Jack's boat landing. She imagines Jay touching other women. She remembers her father lifting other little girls on his lap, demanding that Bev bring home playmates just so he could cuddle with them and make her watch. He was a handsome, successful businessman, and during her teenage years the object of her friends' crushes.
He touched them in ways that weren't obvious or reportable, just what he considered innocent contact between his hard penis and their buttocks as they sat on his lap. He never exposed himself or talked in a vulgar manner, never even swore. Worst of all, when he accidentally brushed against their breasts, her friends liked it, and sometimes they brushed against him first. Bev walked out on him one day and never went back, the same way her mother had when Bev was 3, leaving her with him and his needs. Bev grew up addicted to men, going from one to the next. Leaving Jay is another matter entirely, and she isn't sure why she hasn't done it yet. She isn't sure why she'll do whatever he demands, despite her fears for her own safety. The thought of him going off in the boat one day and never returning sears her with terror. It would serve her right, since that's what she did to her father, who was dropped by a heart attack in 1997. Bev didn't go to his funeral. Now and then, when she's headed to shore, she thinks of the Mississippi River. On a good day, she could make it there in less than 6 hours, and she senses Jay is on to her occasional impulse to escape to the Gulf Coast. He's told her more than once that the Mississippi is the biggest river in the United States, more than 1 million miles of rough, muddy water and tributaries that fan out into thousands of creeks, marshes, and swamps, where a person could get so lost she would end up a skeleton in her boat, as Jay puts it. Those are his words exactly, saying she and her instead of he and his. His choice of words, no accident. Jay doesn't have accidents of the tongue or anything else. All the same, when Bev is out in the boat, she fantasizes about the Mississippi, about riverboat cruises and casinos, about fruity cocktails and beer in frozen glasses, and maybe watching Mardi Gras from a nice air-conditioned hotel window. She wonders if good food would make her sick, now that she's gone so long without it. A comfortable bed would probably stiffen her up and make her sore, because she's so accustomed to a stinking, broken-down mattress that not even Jay will sleep on anymore. She motors around a semi-submerged log, worried at first that it might move and prove to have teeth, and she begins to itch, especially beneath the tight waistband of her jeans. Shit! She steers with one hand and digs the other under her clothes, clawing at her flesh as her welts get bigger. God damn it! Oh, shit, what the fuck's bit me now? Breathing hard and beginning to panic, she shoves the throttle lever into neutral, opens the hatch, and rummages in her beach bag for the insect repellent, spraying herself all over, including under her clothes. It's all in her head, Jay always says. The welts aren't bites, they're hives, because she has a nervous condition, because she's half crazy. Well, I wasn't half crazy until I met you, she answers him in her head. I never got hives in my life, nothing like that, not even poison ivy. Bev drifts in the creek for a minute or two, contemplating what she's about to do, and imagining Jay's face when she brings him what he wants, then imagining his face if she doesn't. She advances the throttle and trims out, speeding up to 40 miles an hour, which is much too fast for this part of the Tickfaw, and reckless in light of her fears of the dark water and what's beneath it. Sweeping left, she abruptly cuts back her speed and trims down, heeling into a turn that takes her into a narrow creek, where she runs slowly and quietly into marshland that smells like death. Reaching under the tarp, she slides out the shotgun and lays it across her lap. 23. Sunlight illuminates a sliver of Benton's face as he stares out the window. Silence reigns for a long, tense moment. The air seems to shimmer ominously, and Marino rubs his eyes.
I don't get it. His mouth quivers. You could be free. Go home. Be alive again. His voice cracks. I thought you'd at least thank my ass for going to all the trouble to come here and tell you that maybe Lucy and me ain't ever given up on getting you back.
By offering her? Benton turns around and looks at him.
By offering Kay as bait?
At last he says her name, but he is so calm it is as if he has no feelings, and Marino is shocked. He wipes his eyes.
Bait? What?
Isn't it enough what the bastard has already done to her? Benton goes on. He tried to kill her once. He's not talking about Jean-Baptiste. He's talking about Jay Talley.
He ain't gonna kill her when he's sitting behind bulletproof glass, chatting away on a phone inside a maximum security prison, Marino says, as they continue to talk about two different people.
You're not listening to me, Benton tells him.
That's because you're not listening to me, Marino childishly retorts.
Benton turns off the air conditioner and slides up the window. He closes his eyes as a breeze touches his hot cheeks like cool fingers. He smells the burgeoning earth. For an instant, he remembers being alive with her, and he begins to bleed inside like a hemophiliac.
Does she know? He asks.
Marino rubs his face.
Jesus! I'm so sick and tired of my blood pressure shooting up like I'm a damn thermometer.
Tell me. Benton presses his palms against the window frame, leaning into the fresh air. He turns around and meets Marino's eyes.
Does she know?
Marino gets his meaning and sighs.
No, hell no. She don't know. She'll never know unless you're the one who tells her. I wouldn't do that to her. Lucy wouldn't do that to her. See,
he angrily pulls himself to his feet.
Some of us care too much about it to hurt her like that. Imagine how she'd feel if she knew you're alive and don't care a shit about her anymore.
He walks to the door, shaking with rage and grief.
I thought you might thank me.
I do thank you.
I know you mean well.
Benton walks over to him, his calm demeanor uncanny.
I know you don't understand, but maybe someday you will. Goodbye, Pete. I don't ever want to see or hear from you again. Please don't take it personally.
Marino grabs the doorknob and almost yanks it out of the wood.
Good riddance and go fuck yourself. Don't take it personally.
They face each other like two men squaring off in a gunfight, neither wanting to be the first to move, neither really wanting the other to be gone from his life. Benton's hazel eyes are vacant, as if whoever lives behind them has vanished. Marino's pulse measures panic as he realizes that the Benton he knew is gone and nothing will ever bring him back. And somehow Marino is going to have to tell Lucy. And somehow Marino will have to accept the fact that his dream of rescuing Benton and returning him to Scarpetta will always be a dream. Only a dream.
It don't make sense, Marino shouts.
Benton touches an index finger to his lips.
Please go, Pete, he quietly says. It doesn't have to make sense.
Marino hesitates in the dimly lit, stinking landing just beyond apartment 56.
Okay.
He fumbles for his cigarettes and spills several on the filthy concrete.
Okay,
he starts to say Benton, but catches himself as he squats to pick up the cigarettes, his thick fingers clumsily breaking two of them. He wipes his eyes with the back of a big hand as Benton looks down at him from the apartment doorway, watching, not offering to help pick up the cigarettes, unable to move.
Take care, Pete,
Benton, the master of masks and self-control, says in a steady, reasonable voice. Marino looks up with bloodshot eyes from his squatting position on the landing. The seam in the crotch of his wrinkled khakis is slightly ripped, his white briefs peeking through. He blurts out,
"Don't you get it? You can come back." What you don't get is there is no back to go back to,
Benton says in a voice so low it is almost inaudible.
I don't want to come back. Now please get the hell out of my life and leave me alone.
He pulls his apartment door shut and flips the deadbolt. Inside, he collapses on the couch and covers his face with his hands while Marino's insistent knocking turns to violent thuds and kicks.
"Yeah, well, enjoy your great life, asshole," his muffled voice sounds through the door. "I always knew you was cold and don't give a fuck about anybody, including her, you fucking psycho."
The banging and kicking suddenly stop. Benton holds his breath, straining to hear. The sudden silence is worse than any tantrum. Pete Marino's silence is damning. It is final. His friend's heavy feet scuff down the stairs.
I am dead, Benton mutters into his hands as he doubles over on the couch. No matter what, I am dead. I am Tom. Tom Haviland. Tom Speck Haviland.
His chest heaves and his heart seems to beat out of rhythm. Born in Greenwich, Connecticut.
He gets up, crushed by a depression that turns the room dark and the air as thick as oil. He smells Marino's lingering cigarette smoke and it runs through him like a blade. Moving to the window, he stands to one side of it so he isn't visible from below, and he watches Pete Marino walking slowly away through intermittent shadows and dappled sunlight along uneven cobblestones. Marino stops to light a lucky strike and turns around to stare up at Benton's depressing building until he finds apartment 56. Cheap sheer curtains are caught by a breeze and flutter out the open window like spirits leaving.
24. In Poland, it is a few minutes past midnight. Lucy drives past caravans of World War II Russian Army trucks and speeds through miles of tiled tunnels and along the tree-lined E-28. She can't stop thinking about the red notice. How easy it was for her to send computerized information that has law enforcement agencies around the world on guard. Of course, her information is legitimate. Rocco Caggiano is a criminal. She has known that for years. But until she recently received information that ties him to at least a few of his crimes, neither she nor other interested parties had probable cause to do anything more than hate him. One simple phone call. Lucy called Interpol's Central Bureau in Washington, D.C. She identified herself, her real identity, of course, and had a brief conversation with a U.S. Marshal liaison named McCord. The next step was a search of the Interpol database to see if Caggiano is known, and he wasn't, not even as a green notice, which simply means a person is of interest to Interpol and should be watched and subjected to extra scans and pat-downs when he or she crosses borders and passes through international airports. Rocco Caggiano is in his mid-30s. He has never been arrested and has made a fortune, ostensibly as a scumbag ambulance-chasing lawyer, but his formidable wealth and power come from his real client, the Shandons, although it isn't accurate to call them a client. They own him. They shield him. He is kept in high style and alive at their pleasure.
Check out a murder in 1997, Lucy told McCord. New Year's Day in Sicily. A journalist named Carlos Guarino. Shot in the head, his body dumped in a drainage ditch. He was working on an investigative story about the Shandons, a very risky thing to do, by the way. He had just interviewed a lawyer who represents Jean-Baptiste Shandon.
Right, right. I know about that case. The Wolfman, or whatever they call him. The cover of People magazine, Time magazine, whatever. Who doesn't know about the Wolfman serial killer, I guess? Lucy replied. Guarino was murdered hours after talking to Caggiano.
Next, a journalist named Emmanuel Lafleur, Barbizon, France, February 11th, 1997, worked for Le Monde. He also was unwisely doing a story on the Shandon family.
Why all this interest in the Shandons, beyond their being Jean-Baptiste's unlucky parents?
Organized crime, a huge cartel. Never been proven that the father heads it, but he does. There are rumors. Investigative reporters are sometimes blinded by scoops and prizes.
Lafleur had drinks with Caggiano hours before the journalist's body was found in a garden near the former chateau of the painter, Jean-François Millet. Don't bother looking for him. He's been dead more than 100 years.
She wasn't being sarcastic. She would never assume that Millet is a household name and didn't want to find the artist was suddenly a person of interest.
Lafleur was shot in the head, and the 10-millimeter bullet was fired from the same gun used to murder Guarino, she explained.
There was more. The information came from a letter written by Jean-Baptiste Shandon.
I'll email you his letter immediately, Lucy said, a transmission that would have been unthinkable before Interpol began using the Internet. But the International Police Agency's computerized communication network has more than enough firewalls, hieroglyphical encryptions, and hacker tracking systems to render any transmissions secure. Lucy knows. When Interpol began to use the Internet, the Secretary General personally invited her to hack her way in. She couldn't. She never made it past the first firewall, and secretly was furious at being foiled, even though the last thing she should have wanted was success. The Secretary General called her, quite amused. He read to her a list of her usernames, passwords, and the location of her computer.
"Don't worry, Lucy. I won't send the police," he said.
"Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Hartman," she replied to the Secretary General, who is American. From New York to London to Berlin, and now crossing the border into Poland, police have been alert. She sensed that. But they didn't take her seriously. Could have cared less about this young American woman driving her rented Mercedes at a late hour on a cool spring night. To them, she clearly doesn't look like a terrorist, and she isn't. But she could be, easily. And it is foolish not to take her seriously, for no reason beyond her nationality, youthfulness, appearance, and a smile that can be warm and captivating when she chooses. She is far too smart to carry a firearm. Her tactical baton will do if she runs into a problem, not from the police, but from some asshole along the way who might have singled her out for robbery or some other type of assault. The baton was easy for her to smuggle into Germany. She used her shop-worn routine because it has never failed. Overnighted it in a cosmetic bag filled with a jumble of accessories, curling iron, curling brush, blow dryer, etc. The package arrived at a cheap hotel near the airport, addressed to one of Lucy's aliases, who also had a room reserved and paid for in that name. Lucy drove her rental car to the hotel, parked on a side street, picked up the package at check-in, messed up her room a bit, and hung a do-not-disturb sign on the door. She was back in her car in half an hour. If a more serious weapon is imperative on a mission, a handgun and extra magazines of ammunition are tucked inside alleged lost baggage, sloppily bound in airline tape, and dumped at the hotel desk by one of Lucy's associates, dressed for the part. She has many associates. Most of them have never met her and don't know who she is. Only her core team knows her. She has them and they have her. It is enough. She plucks her international cell phone from between her legs and presses redial. "I'm on the go," she says when Rudy Musil answers. "An hour 15 out if I don't speed too much."
"Don't."
A television plays loudly in the background. Lucy eyes the speedometer as it eases past 120 kilometers per hour. She might be brazen, but never intentionally foolish. She has no intention of getting entangled with police as she heads toward the most prominent but beleaguered port city in Poland. Americans aren't often seen in Szczecin. Why would Americans go there? Certainly not for tourism, unless it is to look at nearby concentration camps. For years now, the Germans have been intercepting foreign vessels en route to the Szczecin port. Daily, the Germans steal business from a city where unemployment and economic depression continue to corrode what once was a jewel of architecture, culture, and art. Very little glory has been restored to Szczecin since World War II, when Hitler set out to bomb Poland off the map and exterminate its people. It is impossible to earn a decent living. Few people know what it is like to live in a nice house, drive a nice car, wear nice clothes, buy books, or go on vacation. It is said that no one but members of the Russian mafia and criminal cartels have money in Poland, and with rare exception this is true. Lucy constantly scans the highway and her smile fades, her eyes narrow. "Taillights ahead. I don't like it," she says into the cell phone. "Someone's slowing." She eases up on the accelerator. "Stopping in the middle of the fucking highway. No place to pull over."
"Don't stop. Go around it," Rudy tells her.
"Disabled limousine. Weird to see an American limo in these parts." Lucy swerves around a white stretch Lincoln. The driver and a passenger are climbing out, and she resists the urge to stop and help. "Shit," she mutters in frustration.
"Don't even think about it," Rudy warns,
well aware of Lucy's high-risk personality and compulsion to save the world. She pushes down the accelerator, and the limousine and its stranded passengers become part of the thick darkness behind her.
"The front desk is empty at this hour. You know where you're going," Rudy makes sure.
There can be no mistakes and no sightings. Lucy repeatedly glances in the rearview mirror, worrying that the limousine might be gaining on her and turn out to be real trouble. Her stomach tightens. What if those people back there genuinely need help? She left them alone in the dark on E-28, where there is no way to pull off the road. They'll probably get run over by a truck. For several seconds, she considers speeding to the next exit and turning around. She does it for lost dogs, for turtles crossing highways and streets. She always brakes for chipmunks and squirrels and runs outside to check on birds that fly into her windows. But people are another matter. She can't afford to take the chance.
"You can't miss the Radisson," Rudy is saying. "Don't park in the courtyard for buses. They don't appreciate it."
He is joking. It goes without saying that Lucy will not park at the Radisson. 25. Delray Beach, Florida, is hot at 6 o'clock p.m., and Kay Scarpetta turns away from her kitchen window, deciding she will work another hour before venturing outside. She has become an expert in judging shadows and light, monitoring them in her scientific manner before heading out to check on her fruit trees or walk on the beach, making rather useless decisions based on analysis and calculations of how the sun moves across the sky. Helps her feel as though she has not lost complete control of her life. Her two-story yellow stucco house is modest by her standards, just an old place with wobbly white railings, failing plumbing and wiring, and air conditioning that seems to have a mean-spirited will of its own. Tiles sometimes fall out of the backsplash behind the electric stove, and yesterday the bathtub's cold water handle pulled loose from the wall. For the sake of survival, she has read home repair books and manages to keep her surroundings from falling on her head, as she tries not to remember what days were like before she relocated hundreds of miles south of her former career and barely an hour's drive north of Miami, where she was born. The past is dead, and death is just one more phase of existence. This is her creed. Most of the time, she believes it. Time on Earth is an opportunity to become more highly evolved, and then people move on or cross over, a concept that by no means is original to her, but she is not one to accept what isn't obvious without dissecting it first. After much contemplation, her findings about eternity are simple. No one good or evil ceases to exist. Life is energy, and energy cannot be created or destroyed. It is recycled. Therefore, it is possible that the pure of heart and the purely evil have been here before and will be here again. Scarpetta doesn't believe in heaven or hell, and she no longer goes to Mass, not even on religious holidays. "What happened to your Catholic guilt?" Lucy asked her several Christmases ago, when they were mixing a strong batch of eggnog and church was not on the agenda. "I can't participate in something I no longer believe in," Scarpetta replied, reaching for freshly ground nutmeg, "especially if I am at odds with it, which is worse than having a complete loss of faith in it." "The question is, what is it? Are you talking about Catholicism or God?" "Politics and power. They have an unmistakable stench, rather much like the inside of the morgue fridge. I can close my eyes and know what's there. Nothing alive."
"Thanks for sharing," Lucy said. "Maybe I'll just drink a little straight rum on the rocks. Raw eggs suddenly don't seem very appealing."
"You're not the least bit squeamish." Scarpetta poured Lucy a glass of eggnog, adding a sprinkle of nutmeg. "Drink up before Marino gets here and there's none left." Lucy smiled. The only thing that makes her gag is walking into a ladies' room and finding someone in the middle of changing a baby's diaper. To Lucy, that stench is worse than a decomposing body buzzing with blowflies, and she has experienced her share of offensive horrors because of her and her aunt's unusual occupations.
"This mean you no longer believe in eternity?"
Lucy challenged her.
"I believe in it more than ever."
Scarpetta has made the dead speak most of her life, but always through the silent language of injuries, trace evidence, diseases, and investigative details that can be interpreted with medicine, science, experience, and deduction that borders on the intuitive, a gift that cannot be learned or taught. But people change. She is no longer entirely clinical. She has come to accept that the dead continue to exist and intervene in the lives of their earthbound loved ones and enemies. It is a conviction that she conceals from her detractors, and certainly never mentions in professional presentations, or in journal articles, or in court. I've seen psychics on TV talking about people dying and crossing over. I believe that's the term, Lucy observed, sipping her eggnog. I don't know. It's pretty interesting. The older I get, the less certain I am of most things. I've noticed your advanced aging process, Scarpetta replied. When you turn 30, you will begin to have visions and see auras. Let's hope you don't get arthritis. This conversation took place in Scarpetta's former home in Richmond, a fortress of stone she designed with love and an abandonment of financial reason, sparing no expense in her insistence on old woods, exposed beams, solid doors and plaster walls, and a kitchen and office that were perfect for her precise way of going about her business, whether it was over a microscope or a Viking gas stove. Life was good. Then it wasn't and never would be again. So much went wrong. So much was spoiled and lost and could never be restored. 3 years ago, she was well along her journey to disaster. She had resigned as president of the National Association of Medical Examiners. The governor of Virginia was about to fire her. One day she cleared her office wall of scores of commendations, certifications, and degrees that are now packed up somewhere in cardboard boxes. The pre-crash Scarpetta was impeccably, if not rigidly, intellectual, completely confident of her knowledge, her truthfulness, and her ability to excavate for answers. She was a legend in law enforcement and criminal justice, and to some people, unapproachable and cold. Now she has no staff except her secretary, Rose, who followed her to Florida with the excuse that it would be nice to retire near West Palm Beach. Scarpetta can't get over Benton Wesley. She has tried. Several times she has dated perfectly acceptable men, only to recoil at their touch. A simple touch, and it isn't Benton's. And then she is reminded. Then she reviews her last images of him, burned, mutilated. She still regrets reading his autopsy report, and yet she doesn't. She regrets touching his ashes and scattering them, and yet she doesn't. It was crucial, it really was, she constantly tells herself, when she remembers the feel of the silky, lumpy remains, when she remembers returning him to the pure air and sea he loved. She wanders out of the kitchen, clutching the same mug of coffee she has warmed up in the microwave at least 4 times since noon. "Dr. Scarpetta, can I get you anything?" Rose calls out from a spare bedroom that serves as her office. "Nothing would help," Scarpetta replies, halfway joking, as she heads in the direction of Rose's voice. "Nonsense." It is her secretary's favorite rebuttal. "I told you if you went to work for yourself, you'd only be busier if that was possible, and worn out and overextended. And what did I tell you about retirement?" Rose looks up from the autopsy report she is proofreading on her computer. She tabs to the space for brain and types 1,200 grams within normal limits, and corrects a typo. Nails click across the wooden floor like Morse code as Scarpetta's bulldog hears voices and walks rather lazily, then pauses, then walks some more toward them, then sits. "Come here, Billy Billy," Scarpetta affectionately calls out. He looks at her with drooping eyes. His name is Billy, Rose reminds her, although there is no point in doing so. If you keep calling him Billy Billy, he'll think he lives with an echo or has a split personality. Come here, Billy Billy. He gets up, takes his time. Click, click. Rose is wearing a peach pantsuit. It is wool, as are all of Rose's suits. The house is on the beach. It is bloody hot and humid, and Rose doesn't hesitate to walk outside in a skirt and long-sleeved blouse and water the hibiscus, climb a ladder to pick bananas or key limes, or save baby frogs from drowning in the trap of the pool. It's a wonder that moths haven't carried off every bit of clothing Rose owns, but she is a proud woman, her dignity masking a fragile, gentle nature, and it is out of respect for herself and her boss that she takes time each morning to make sure her choice of outfits for the day is pressed and clean. If anything, she seems secretly pleased that her sense of style is dated. Some of her suits so old that she had been wearing them more than a decade ago when she first started working for Scarpetta. Rose hasn't changed her hair either, still pinning it up in a fuss-budget French twist and refusing to get rid of the gray. Good structure makes the building, and her bones are exquisite. At the age of 67, men find her attractive, but she hasn't dated since her husband died. The only man Scarpetta has ever seen her flirt with is Pete Marino, and she doesn't mean it, and he knows it, but they have tormented each other since Scarpetta was appointed chief medical examiner of Virginia, what now seems as though it were another incarnation ago. Billy is panting as he appears at the desk. He is not quite a year old, white with a large brown spot on the middle of his back, and his underbite reminds Scarpetta of a backhoe. He sits at her feet, looking up. "I don't have any—" "Don't say that word," Rose exclaims. "I wasn't going to. I was going to spell it." He can spell now. Billy suffers no language barrier with the words bye-bye and treat. He also recognizes no and sit, but pretends he doesn't. Stubbornness the right of his breed. "You better not have been chewing on anything back there," Scarpetta warns him. In the last month, Billy has taken a fancy to gnawing and ripping molding off door frames and around the base of the walls, especially in Scarpetta's bedroom. "This isn't your house, and I will have to pay for all repairs when I move out," she wags her finger at him. "It would be worse if it was your house," Rose remarks, as the dog continues to stare up at Scarpetta and wag his tail, which looks like a croissant. She picks up a slim stack of mail from her desk and offers it to her boss. "I've dealt with the bills. There are a couple of personal letters, and the usual journals and so forth, and this from Lucy." She directs Scarpetta's attention to a large manila envelope, her name and address neatly written in black magic marker, the return address Lucy's New York office, also written in magic marker. The envelope is marked personal in large letters and underlined twice. It is a die-hard habit for Scarpetta to look at postmarks, and this one is puzzling. "The postal code isn't for her part of the city," Scarpetta says. "Lucy always mails things from her office, and as a matter of fact, she always overnights mail to me. I can't remember a single time she's ever sent me anything by regular mail. Not since she was in college." Rose doesn't seem concerned. "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds," she quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson. In fact, it is her favorite quote. Rose shakes the envelope. "Doesn't sound like anything dangerous in there," she teases. "If you're feeling one of your bouts of paranoia coming on, I'll open it for you, but it's marked personal." "Never mind." Scarpetta takes it and her other mail from Rose. "And Dr. Lanier from Baton Rouge left a message." Rose pecks at the keyboard and corrects another typo. "It's regarding the Charlotte Dard case. He says you'll get it Monday, his reports and all that. He sounded stressed. He wants to know what you find out immediately." She gives her boss a look that always reminds Scarpetta of a schoolteacher about to single out some unsuspecting student and put him or her on the spot. "I think something's going on in this case, something worse than a drug overdose." Scarpetta massages Billy's soft, speckled ears. "Her cause of death isn't straightforward. That's plenty bad. What's worse, the case is 8 years old. I don't understand why it's such a big deal right now, as if they don't have enough unsolved murders and suspicious deaths down there. Those abducted women, Lord." "I don't know why it's suddenly become a priority either," Scarpetta replies. "But the fact is it has, and I feel obliged to do what I can, because nobody else can be bothered." "I can be bothered, can't I, Billy Billy? Well, let me tell you a thing or two, Dr. Echo. I think there's something the coroner down there has no intention of telling you." "There had better not be," Scarpetta remarks as she walks off. 26. Lucy desperately needs a ladies' room. Forget looking for a gas station or a rest stop. She pushes the Mercedes up to 160 kilometers per hour, despite Rudy's warning about speeding. Focusing on the dark road, she tries hard to concentrate and ignore her bladder. The drive seems to take twice as long as it should, but she makes excellent time and is ahead of schedule by 35 minutes. She redials Rudy's cell phone.
On final, she says. Just got to land this thing somewhere.
Shut up, Rudy orders someone in the room as the TV plays loudly. Don't make me tell you again.
27. Rocco Caggiano's favorite form of relaxation is to sit for hours in beer gardens, drinking one gross beer after another. The pale gold elixirs are served in tall, plain glasses, and he prefers clean-tasting lagers and will not touch wheat beers. Rocco has never understood how he can drink a gallon of beer in one sitting, but not a gallon of water. He could not drink a gallon of water during an entire day, probably not even in 3 days, and he is always puzzled over how much beer, wine, champagne, or mixed drinks he can put away when he can scarcely finish a single glass of water. In fact, he hates water. Perhaps what a psychic once told him is true. He drowned in a former life. What a terrible way to die. And he often thinks of the killer in England who drowned one wife after another in the tub by grabbing her feet and yanking until her head was under water and she could do nothing but helplessly flop her arms like a fish on a dock. The scenario was a constant emotional itch when Caggiano began to hate his first wife, then his second. Alimony was cheaper than the price he would pay if some medical examiner discovered bruises or God knows what. But even if he did drown in a former life and thought drowning someone was a good way to commit murder, this, in his mind, would not explain the enigma, the purely biological phenomenon, of how much alcohol he can consume and why he cannot and will not finish even one glass of water. No one has ever been able to settle his mind with an answer he accepts. Small conundrums have always worried him like a sand spur stuck to his sock.
It must be, 'cause you pee all the time when you drink beer.
Caggiano introduces the question at virtually every social gathering.
When you pee, you make room for more, right? You drink a gallon of water, you will be pissing all the time, too,
a Dutch customs agent challenged him some months back, when he, Rocco, and several other friends of the Shandun cartel were taking time out in a beer garden in Munich.
I hate water, Rocco said. Then how do you know this about whether you would pee water as fast as beer?
A German container ship's captain asked.
He doesn't know. Yes, you ought to test it out, Rocco. We'll drink beer, you drink water, and see who pees the most and the fastest.
The men laughed and clanked glasses in a drunken toast, slopping beer all over the wooden table. It had been a good day. Before they caroused at the beer garden, they had wandered into the nudist park, where a naked man on a bicycle pedaled past, and the Dutchman yelled at him in Dutch that he'd better be careful which gear he shifted, while the ship's captain yelled in German that his kickstand was very small. Rocco yelled in English that the man didn't have to worry about his dick getting caught in the spokes because it didn't even hang over the seat. The bicyclist pedaled on, ignoring them. Women sunbathe in the nude in the park and do not seem to care if men stare at them. Rocco and his henchmen would get very brazen and hover right over a woman stretched out on her towel and make comments about her anatomical points of interest. Usually the woman would turn over on her belly and go back to sleep, or continue reading her magazine or book, while the men went on to survey her buttocks as if they were hills they might climb. Rocco's intense arousal would make him mean, and he would fire vile, lewd aspersions at the woman until his companions had to usher him away. Rocco is especially vicious with the homosexuals minding their own business in the park. He believes all homosexuals should be castrated and executed, and he would like to be the one to do it, and watch them pee and defecate out of fright.
"It's a medical fact that when you're tortured or about to be snuffed, you piss and shit in your pants," he announced in the beer garden. "What medical fact? I thought you were a lawyer, not a doctor." "So you know this, Rocco. And how do you know this? You take off their pants to see? Maybe you take their pants off to check for shit and piss?"
Loud laughter.
"Then you can know it as a fact." If this is true, I must come around to my important question. Do you go around taking the pants off dead bodies? I think all of us have a right to hear this. Because at least for me, if I die, I need to know if you will take my pants off.
If you die, Rocco replied, you won't know a fucking thing.
It is irrational that Rocco should remember this boozy conversation and what his doctor has preached to him for years. Rocco has gastritis and cranky bowel syndrome due to stress, smoking, and heavy drinking. All ills in life are blamed on acute stress, smoking, and heavy drinking, Rocco always retorts on his way out of the examination room. He files for medical reimbursement and resumes his self-destructive life. His bowels and bladder let loose as he sits in a chair inside his hotel room, a Colt 380 cocked and pointed at his head. 28. Jack's boat landing is a clutter of trailers, bateaux, bass and flat-bottom boats, and runabouts tied to pilings along a crisscross of rickety docks strung with old tires that serve as fenders. Pulled up on the muddy shore are several pirogues or Cajun canoes, and a rotting bow rider that won't be pulling water skiers anymore. The parking lot is dirt, and on the fuel dock are two pumps, one for regular gas, the other for diesel. Jack works from 5 a.m. until 9 p.m. in his one-room office with its mounted fish hanging at random angles on the wall with peeling paint. The calendar above his old metal desk features glossy photos of glitter-painted bass boats, the very expensive kind that can go up to 60 miles an hour. Were it not for the window air conditioning unit and the port-a-john behind the building, Jack would lack all modern conveniences. Not that he would care, particularly. He was born into a hard life and raised to make any sacrifice that might keep him right where he is, in a world of water and the creatures in it, and trees draped in Spanish moss. For those who frequent his boat landing, tying up for gas and making a trip into town for provisions is normal behavior. People who stay for weeks or longer in their fishing camps on the bayous and rivers are expected to leave vehicles and boat trailers parked at the landing. He never thinks twice about the white Jeep Cherokee tucked between trucks and other SUVs in a far corner of the lot near the water's edge. He minds his own business, even if he does have instincts about people that are as strong as his sense of smell. Swamp Woman sent strong signals to him from day one, and that's been some 2 years now. Her demeanor is no-nonsense about asking personal questions. Bev Kiffin opens the hatch and pulls out her beach bag. She stands aft and drops in the plow anchor, then tosses two nylon lines up on the fuel dock as Jack waves, walking swiftly her way.
"Why, if it isn't Swamp Woman," he calls out, "can I top you off?"
The landing is lit and bugs are thick roiling clouds in the yellow glow of lamps. Jack tosses her the bow line.
"I'll be leaving her here for a few hours."
Bev turns the rope and makes a half hitch over the horns of the cleat. She pulls back the tarp and sets empty gas cans on the dock.
"Fill 'em up. What's your price these days?"
$185.
Shit.
Bev hops up on the dock, moving nimbly for a woman her size.
"That's highway robbery."
Jack laughs.
"It ain't me who decides the price of oil."
He's tall and bald, as dark and strong as a cypress. Bev's never seen him once when he wasn't wearing his sweat-stained orange Harley Davidson cap and chewing on a plug of tobacco.
"You coming and going?"
He spits and wipes his mouth on the back of a sun-spotted, gnarled hand and helps her with the stern lines.
"Just to the store."
Bev dips into her beach bag for a single key attached to a small fishing bobber in case she ever accidentally drops the key into the water.
This book is continued on Disc 4.